Right, let's get going. Hi, everyone. Welcome to our latest Employment Law 101 session, which today is all about collective redundancy consultations. My name is Peter. I'm a partner with a specialist employment and business immigration practice called MPM Legal. I am delighted to be joined today by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning, back from holiday, ready to jump into the fray again.
Back and refreshed and ready to get going with some
I
more
don't know about
education and
refreshed.
discussion on collective redundancy consultation, which I'm sure you were absolutely thrilled about doing whilst you were away. Thinking about going back
Delighted.
to do this. For those of you that haven't joined us before, we do record these sessions, so you can always dip into them later. They'll be on our website. If you're joining live, you absolutely have the opportunity to ask questions. Please just use the Q&A function down at the bottom. If you happen to be listening to us at some point in the future on Spotify or Amazon Music, where all of our back episodes are now held, everything we're talking about today is valid as at today's date, which is 14th of March 2024. So I just want to make that clear. And of course, you're not able to ask us any questions. So by all means, look out for us on LinkedIn. We're at MPM Legal. You can contact us through that medium. But otherwise, if you're joining today and you've got questions on this topic, then please do chip in. So today, as we say, collective redundancy consultation, we wanted to do just a little update on this because it just seems that we're quite busy as a practice at the moment in dealing with various processes, collective processes. And there's quite a lot of business reorganization going on at the moment. And it's just on our radar that some of you may be planning future exercises and just need a bit of a refresher in terms of what exactly you can prepare for and what collective processes entails. So the key thing about collective redundancy consultation is it's a whole separate set of rules that come under a different bit of legislation to the Employment Rights Act. So if you think about your ordinary unfair dismissal redundancy rules, they're contained within the Employment Rights Act, and you'll be familiar with those from where you're dealing with small scale exercises like one, two, three, four people. When you get into larger numbers, and Adrienne's going to come on just talk about the significance of the numbers, a separate set of rules are engaged, and that's the Trade Union and Labour Relations Consolidation Act from 1992, which is a bit of a mouthful, so I'm not going to repeat it all. Again, I just call it TULCRA, even though I know that acronym's not 100% correct. So under TULCRA, there's a whole set of collective consultation rules, and they talk specifically about the process that needs to be followed, who you need to engage, what information you need to provide, so on and so forth. And that's what we're going to run through in the next 25 minutes or so. I think it's important to note as well that the rules that you're following on collective redundancy consultation exercises, they don't replace the Employment Rights Act rules. So they run in parallel with those Employment Rights Act rules. So what that boils down to is you've got to be mindful of individual redundancy consultation still, as well as collective consultation. So one doesn't replace the other. And it is possible to get the collective part right, but get the individual bit wrong, in which case you might still be facing liability for ordinary unfair dismissal claims under the Employment Rights Act. Now, you'll see as we come on and talk about potential pitfalls, there's a much larger liability under collective consultation. So it absolutely is important to get that right as well. But don't look at the TULCRA rules for collective as supplanting the individual consultation runs. So they complement each other, and you do need to be mindful of both of them, don't you, Adrienne?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I think there has even been cases on it where companies have gone through the collective process and have tried to argue that because everything's been done and agreed with the reps, then it was okay just then to go ahead and dismiss as redundant the employees, where individual conversations had not been had with those individuals. And you know, that's reaffirmed the position that no, that results in an unfair dismissal. So yeah, it's important not to forget that. I think it's also, we've only got half an hour today, so I think we need to apologize up front if we're not covering absolutely everything, because we're only picking out a handful of bits and pieces. So if you need any more information about the process, by all means get in touch. We're really happy to run future sessions or support you in your business's particular needs. But let me just talk a little bit about the numbers, because here, you know, you might sit down as a company and go, right, actually, you know, we're going to have to do some large-scale changes. We've got a big reduction in force is a typical phrase that we hear used, as well as collective redundancies. So, you know, yeah, so riff, yeah, if we're having to do a riff. And so you have to think about, realistically, each time you're making redundancies, whether or not the collective process has been engaged. And it's not just simple to say, right, for this process, we've got 25 people engaged. Brilliant, that's fine. That's the collective process. That's relatively straightforward. But what happens if you say, right, okay, we're only planning on making 8 people redundant. That's all an individual process. But it is not as straightforward as that, because the problem is that you need to look backwards and forwards in terms of your 90-day period. Because if you remember, the collective process is engaged when you are proposing to dismiss as redundant 20 or more employees in a 90-day period. So it's really important that you look at that rolling 90-day period. So, for example, you may have already made 11 individual redundancies, and then you've got this further 8 that would go into the same 90-day period. So they would be leaving your business in the same 90-day period as your previous 11. That will actually mean that you hit the threshold for the requirement for collective consultation. So, as I say, you need to look back to make sure that you're not falling foul of that requirement. I do know that some of our clients do keep a tracker to make sure that they don't fall foul of this. And, you know, that's obviously a really good idea and quite sophisticated in my view. I think it's also important to remember that wider definition of redundancy for the purposes of collective consultation. And I think we touched on this before when we were talking about changing terms and conditions of employment, where you'd discuss changes that you want to make to contracts which would impact several individuals within your business. So if you've had that process already, but you hadn't hit the collective number, you know, if you're now making further redundancies, you would have to include those people in order to work out whether you've hit that threshold. So I can probably feel some of you kind of going, oh, my God, what does this actually mean? What does that mean in terms of who you consult with? And I can honestly say that it is a little bit of a nightmare, isn't it, Peter? You know, because obviously if you've been through an individual process with individuals, some of whom may have already left, then, you know, does that mean that potentially you have to open up the consultation process that you've already been through, because your new round of 8 means that the collective process applies? Well, obviously, if they've already left, there's not much you can do about it. But technically speaking, if you are still in a consultation process, an individual consultation process with people, then potentially you would have to go back and go, actually, that needs to now be a collective process. And frankly, it's a mess. There's no two ways about it. And often, you know, a lot of our clients will just, you know, take a bit of a risk in that particular scenario and say, well, we've already started consulting with those individuals, so we'll carry on. Much of it is going to just depend where you are in that process.
I think it's a bit of a considered risk with it. And then to add kind of further complication into it, if I can use the B word, Brexit, because of our divergence now from EU rules, I mean, all of these rules we're talking about in terms of collective consultation, they flow down from an EU directive. So they're European Union derived historically, but they've been around in one way, one shape or another since, I think, 1975, for so a long, long time. It's just there was a lot of legislative change in the 1990s. And there's an argument that when you look at the European level directive wording, it only is couched in terms of things that are happening in the future.
Yeah.
So, you know, obviously, you don't want to be one of those businesses that is on the receiving end of some kind of really funky technical legal challenge around what should be incorporated. But, you know, it's worthwhile taking advice at the time if you're unsure of it. And there might be an occasion where the advice is, well, actually, you can take a commercial risk here, weighing up where you've got to in terms of an ongoing individual consultation process and how to run it from there. I think just touching on the other point you mentioned there, things that are short of redundancy, so business reorganizations are not going to engage these rules. So if you're making changes that the contract already permits, or the changes that you're looking to make to your workforce are not serious, if I can use that word, it's probably not quite right, but not serious enough to engage, maybe not substantive enough to engage any material change to terms and conditions of employment. So it's kind of doesn't meet the threshold of what a redundancy actually is, then these rules are not going to be engaged. But there are situations where I have spoken to clients and who have almost come unstuck in contract change scenarios where they want to run a dismiss and re-engage type process. And although dismissal and re-engagement, if you're doing that to more than 20 people, there wouldn't necessarily be redundancy dismissals. It would be some other substantial reason. Certainly the rules on collective redundancy can be triggered still, even though in your head you're thinking, well, hey, we've got a job for everybody. Yeah. It's just technically you're looking at dismissing under the old contract and re-engaging under the new contract with the new terms in. So be careful not to fall foul of that. So don't get the numbers wrong. When it comes to fixed term workers, don't forget to include those whose fixed term contracts are going to expire before they're due to expire, because that's another trap to potentially fall into. If you've got natural expiry of fixed term contracts, you don't have to count them in the numbers. If you're looking at accelerating the fixed term contracts coming to an end, you do. So what's our second tip? Well, it's all about when you start the consultation. So not getting the consultation process too late in terms of startup. It can be quite difficult, actually, to sometimes pin down when a business actually needs to start the consultation period, because understandably, you have the brain of an organization like an executive committee or a board that are going to be going to and fro in terms of different proposals. And there are going to be discussions about how they might want to structure a business going forward. And question mark, at what point is the consultation requirement actually triggered? Well, first of all, you need to have a proposal that's capable of consultation. So if you've just got something that's super vague or it's not nailed down enough that you could go to people and actually talk to them about it and seek feedback and engagement, you're probably not into the realms of triggering a consultation process. So you need to have something formed, a plan, basically, that you're going to go to your employees with to say, hey, this is what we're proposing to do. We now need to talk to you about it. Obviously, it's a little bit more to it than that, but you need to talk and meaningfully engage, as we'll see. But you need to have a plan. There needs to be something that you can pin down. However, the flip side to that is you don't want to be too far down the path in terms of what your plan is, such that consultation would be meaningless, because the whole point about collective consultation is that there's supposed to be some sort of influence on the decision-making process. So it isn't just an information exercise where you're going to employees and imparting information about what you're going to do. It needs to be, or it ought to be, consultative in nature. And that's something that's quite easily overlooked. So, you know,
yes. So don't go with everything already set in stone, isn't it? Don't,
exactly.
Don't plan to the nth degree. Exactly.
Yeah. Because otherwise, you know, what are you actually talking to your employees about? Let me just chip in there, if I may.
So just one of the things that we often get asked is, you know, when do we start consultation? And there's sort of two points that I always think about as well, which is you want to be far enough down the line so that you're not unnecessarily unsettling your workforce as well, because we all know that once you throw the collective consultation into the mix, then people are going to be distracted. They're not going to be continuing with their work, etc. So it's a fine line of when have you got a proposal ready to talk to people about, as opposed to, well, we might have a proposal, but you know, we might want to make sure that we're sufficiently sure of where we're going so that you don't disrupt the workforce. And the second thing as well is remembering that the amount of planning and getting the reps in place, etc., will often take more time than you think in terms of the consultation process when it will start. And it's that sort of the pre-planning process and getting everybody in place ready to go, right, now we've got the personnel in place, we've got the employee reps, we've got the management reps in place, now we can actively start consultation. Very often that bit at the front is forgotten, or people think that that can be covered in the 30-day period. It can't. And very often that bit will take more time than you think.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And I know we're going to talk a little bit about the whole planning phase before the end. The other thing about the consultation period itself, I'm not going to go into too much detail about the actual consultation process. other than to say the relevance of collective, and this is a big difference between collective and individual, whereas with individual redundancy consultation, there are no set time scales. So it's all just about acting reasonably, because you want to be able to run that defence that redundancy is the reason for dismissal, and you've basically acted reasonably in terms of the fairness of the process that's been followed. I kind of paraphrase that test there, but that essentially is what it's related to. With collective redundancy consultation, the significance of the collective rules is that there's essentially a moratorium on dismissals. So once collective consultation actually starts, which is typically once your employee reps are appointed, you are not allowed to dismiss within a 30 or a 45 day period, depending on the numbers impacted. So 20 to 99 proposed dismissals, you're at 30 days, 100 and above, you're at 45 days. So what that means is, although technically you are allowed to serve notice during that 30 or 45 day period, you can't have the notice and the dismissal therefore actually taking effect within that period. So think of it as like a ban or a prohibition on dismissals actually happening during that process. Now, a lot of people will commonly just say, oh, it's a 30 or a 45 day consultation period. They're not necessarily the same things. I mean, being super pedantic and technical about it, it is just a mandatory waiting period. You may have a situation where a collective consultation doesn't take 45 days. It may only take 35 days. But in that situation, you still can't just have people exit your business before that 45 day waiting period is up. Mm. So we've mentioned about meaningful consultation and in terms of the provision of information to make it meaningful. There is some mandatory information, Adrienne, that has to be provided, isn't there?
Yeah. So once you've got your reps in place, or, you know, obviously if you've got a recognised trade union, that they will be the reps with whom you're consulting, you've got to provide a minimum amount of information. And that's what kicks off the start of the waiting period, as Peter called it. And the information has to be provided in writing, and it covers your business reasons for the proposals, why you're doing it, who's impacted. So you'd set out the number and the description of the employees impacted. So, for example, you know, we're looking to cut 3 out of 8 people from marketing, etc. You break it down in terms of who's going to be potentially impacted. You then have to say who the total number of employees employed by you at that particular establishment. And, you know, that's if you've got more than one site and, you know, you're only looking at one particular site. You then have to set out the proposed selection criteria. But again, it's got to be draft. You're saying this is how we're proposing to select. And that would actually form part and parcel of the consultation that you would then go into with the reps. You would outline your method of carrying out the dismissals. So procedure, the period over time during which the dismissals would take effect, etc. And then you will also have to provide information about what agency workers you're employed. Now, people always ask me this question, do we always have to provide this? And the answer is yes, you have to say what agency workers are working for you, including where they're working and the type of work they're doing for you. And that's essentially so that the reps have the opportunity to explore what work is essentially being given to agency workers that might be jobs that could be saved for those people that are going to be at risk of redundancy. So that's all of that information...
Sorry to interrupt. It's a weird one, that, isn't it? And
is it weird, though? I'm not sure it is. It's all part. I mean, all part of this is all about encouraging transparency, right? So, you know, what employee reps might be really unhappy about is whether or not, you know, they're losing their employees are going to lose their jobs, but agency workers are kept on.
So, well, I'll tell you. I mean, that's why I think it's weird. Because my understanding is that provision was brought in because of the agency worker regs. And you cast your mind back a few years ago when that was all the rage, and we were giving loads of advice in terms of, you know, do we need to give agency workers access to our staff car park, and, you know, all sorts of questions around parity of treatment. And I think the intention behind it was, like you say, it's transparency, so everyone can see where the agency workers are. With the intention of protecting agency worker rights, but it might have the opposite effect. You're saying to employees, hey, look, we've got these agency workers. So then naturally during consultation, employees are going to say, well, have you considered actually cutting back all the agency workers as a means of saving our jobs instead?
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Why I think it's a bit unusual.
Yeah.
We're always asked about it, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the mandatory information that needs to go to the reps. And then, of course, we get on to the HR1 form, which is the form
another
that
bone
you
of contention.
Another bone of contention. Yeah, absolutely. So this is the form that you have to submit to the Secretary of State to put them on notice effectively that you're cutting your workforce. And that form will also set out a lot of this information, but will also include the names of the reps and who they represent, etc. And there is criminal liability attached to the failure to deliver the HR1. I think we mentioned P&O pretty much in every single webinar we do, but it came up in the context of the P&O exercises people will remember. So it's really important to remember to submit that form, and it's available from the internet.
Yeah, I mean, the recent cases we've seen where directors have potentially been prosecuted on it also were in some of the logistics companies, I think, into
One was it CityLink or something? I can't remember the name of the delivery groups, weren't there? There were a couple of them.
Yeah, I think the green and the yellow van, but I forget the name. So don't sue us if it isn't you, CityLink. But somebody nearly got a big slap on the wrists. Now, actually, it's probably worth mentioning that in relation to these rules, there are exemptions if it's not possible for you to run a collective process. You can try and run an argument that wasn't possible, and there are exceptional circumstances which justify why you could depart from the rules. Again, this is something that I have been asked about before. The case law on it has established that that excuse is really, really, really narrow.
Yeah.
Really, it boils down to, are you in an insolvency situation such that decisions need to be made really quickly? But even then, I've seen plenty of insolvency situations, in fact, I've acted in respect of some, where the administrators have not collectively consulted and the tribunal still said, well, you ought to have done, and we're going to issue a protective award. So don't look at those rules if they do come across your desk as a free pass or as some kind of means to wiggle out of collective obligations, because you're highly unlikely to ever be in a scenario where you can refer to them and use them. But there is a possibility, so you might fall into an
exception. It's got to be unforeseeable, unexpected, really, really quick. You know, that whole insolvency thing, if you can see it coming down the line, like, you know your business is running out of money, then the argument is, well, you should have planned ahead and talked to your staff about this. You should have seen it coming. So it is such a high bar, isn't
really
it?
Really high bar. Yeah, really high bar.
Yeah.
So the fourth tip that we've got this morning is just about your employees and upskilling them. And there are a couple of ways to do that. So the first is in respect of employee representative training. This is something that we do quite a lot of. It isn't mandatory. So there isn't a law anywhere that says you have to give your appointed employee representatives training on what redundancy means and what the collective process means and what their function as employee representatives even means. And bear in mind that some of you might have unionized workforces, so you may have standing union reps that you have to go and consult with if the bargaining group is affected. So for some of you who don't recognize trade unions, then you will be going to your employee group and giving them the opportunity to nominate and elect reps, and the reps are the people you then run the collective consultation with. For those of you that do have recognised trade unions, you'll know that you go to the trade union. But either way, both of those two groups can be trained. And quite a lot of our clients will look to train their employees. And the reason for that is it really does help make the process of collective consultation run a bit more smoothly, because you're not going to get questions from those employees saying, well, what's going on here? We don't understand the wider legal context. So you're giving them the skills to understand perhaps what the redundancy framework is, so why a redundancy situation may have arisen, what the basic legal principles are around collective consultation, and importantly, how they can function really, really effectively as employee representatives. So there is some helpful information on the ACAS website. And if you're a regular listener to these sessions, you probably hear me refer to ACAS every other one, because they have so much good guidance on their website. So they have something on there specifically talking about duties for employee representatives, but who's going to go and search that out? And really, unless you've got the inside knowledge, you're not going to know to look and find that information. So there is some real benefit in just coaching and training employee representatives so they get the most out of the process, and importantly, they help your employees really engage, and that feeds into that meaningful consultation piece. Now, that can also, we could apply to union reps as well. They may get their own training from their own trade union, of course, but in my experience, many don't, or it isn't recent enough. So they can attend training also. The other area to think about training is in terms of manager training as well. So this is particularly the case if you're looking at applying some sort of selection criteria and scoring. There's a whole big piece. I mean, we could probably talk for an hour. It might not be the most interesting session, but we could do something all about selection pools, criteria, scoring, how to make it fair, what pitfalls are associated with that. But if you're expecting managers to undertake some form of responsibility in terms of selection scoring, applying selection criteria, it's only fair really that you're giving them the skills to be able to do that, so they know where the guardrails are, because that's going to feed into the overall fairness. And you know, the whole thing you want is to be able to concentrate on running the process and not having to deal with the substance of the process and these difficult decisions that have been made under it, whilst at the same time trying to help people through a scoring exercise and explain legally what's going on, because that's going to be a little bit tricky, isn't it? What about this whole planning piece, Adrian? Because we're quite hot on encouraging people to really think quite a bit in advance in terms of what they want to run on these projects.
Yeah, I mean, I think normally when I see it, people come to me with a list. You know, they've got a list of employees, but I think it's wider than that. So there's all types of things. So you've got to think about who's going to be involved in the consultation from a management point of view to start with. Who's going to actually sit in the room in the meetings? And we talk about manager training for that, but you know, who in your workforce from the management perspective is skilled enough to be able to run one of these consultation meetings? Is there any form of upskilling that's needed there? Then we've got the point that I made earlier about who are you going to actually consult with? Do a consideration of your workforce. Do you have a trade union? Do you have people who are impacted who are not in the trade union? So you could have sort of three different parties, if you like, in any consultation meeting, which would be the management reps, the trade union reps, and also then elected employee representatives who for those employees who aren't covered by any recognition and agreement. So it's worthwhile planning the rep position. In terms of election of employee reps, it's actually down to management to decide the number of employee reps. So have a look at the functions that are involved. You know, how many reps will you need? If you've got small functions, will you combine a couple of them and say we only need one rep? And it's about planning out those types of issues alongside all the documents that you need, the various letters. You might need a ballot form if you have to go through an election process. So it's almost like having a suite of documents at the very start with a project timeline, bearing in mind that timelines are always only really going to be draft because you never know how many consultation meetings you're going to need.
Yeah, I guess the danger of over planning, and I think our tip is plan, but not too much, is you don't want to sort of be a slave to the plan. So you've got to bear in mind that it's a consultation process, and the consultation is going to be about the decision that you're looking at making and the effect of that decision. But you can also talk to the employee representatives about the process that you're intending to follow. So the selection pools you've drawn up, the selection criteria that you're applying as well, your proposed timescales, all of that is up for discussion and consultation also. It's with a view to seek an agreement, but bear in mind, you don't have to reach agreement on all of these points. You just need to try and seek agreement on it. Now, the danger of following a plan slavishly is that you become inflexible and rigid, and then you're not actually consulting or engaging. So you've got to be careful not to go too far in terms of setting these things in stone. You need to have that element of flexibility. But on the flip side, you need a plan, because if you don't have a plan, you're going to be fighting on two fronts. You're going to be trying to run the process whilst you're designing it at the same time, and you're going to be trying to engage on this difficult stuff and make quite difficult decisions as well. So you're going to get a bit of a double whammy.
Yeah, so I think there's that part of the planning, but there's also the sort of like the practicalities of planning. So, you know, you get your reps in place. How are they going to feed back information to the employees that they represent? You know, if it's an in-person situation, then you've got to provide facilities for them to be able to do that. But, you know, we find very often it's done over Teams groups. It's all done remotely now. But the employee reps will have to have a clear understanding of how they're able to reach out to their employees. You know, plan in how much time they're going to need to get the feedback from the employees that they represent so that they can then come back to the next consultation meeting, having collated responses to what you've told them so far. It's those types of practicalities as well that are worth thinking about.
The other thing as well is if you're using settlement agreements because you're paying enhanced redundancy payments and you might have a practice of asking people to sign a settlement agreement to get the enhancement, if you're in a large scale exercise, 50, 75, 100 people, it will take quite a bit of time to, first of all, prepare the settlement agreements. So things you can be thinking about already, obviously, what's the value of the package going to be? So is there going to be one and what's the value of it? What settlement agreement terms would you like to have in place? Who's going to populate all of the settlement agreements? What point in the process are they going to be offered? How much legal fee contribution are you going to give? Are you happy for your employees to go and get 75 lots of legal advice? Or do you want to try and come to an arrangement where you arrange for a completely independent legal advisor to come and advise employees? And obviously that can work really, really effectively. And what are the timescales going to be for all of that? Because actually, administratively, that can be quite a burden on HR as well, we've found.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, in terms of the costs of getting it wrong then, just to round off, obviously we've mentioned about this form HR1, haven't we, and how there's scope for legal liability, criminal liability for directors if an HR1 is not completed. So assuming that you all get that right and there's no issue there, what about liability in terms of getting the process wrong or just failing to collectively consult? Because it's quite big, isn't it? It's a rare example of punitive damages in employment.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, obviously, you could potentially face the usual unfair dismissal claims, and compensation is always based on losses suffered by the employee. But as Peter's just said, the penalty for getting the collective process wrong is a punitive measure and can lead to an award of up to 90 days' pay. Now, there's several different ways in which claims can be brought. So if you've missed collective consultation entirely, then the employees themselves can bring claims for failure in respect of the election of employee reps or having employee reps in place. But if employee reps are in place, but there has been other failures under the Section 188 stuff, for example, a failure under the consultation process, it's the employee reps that can bring the claims. And obviously the trade unions, if they are in place, can also bring claims. And it's, as I said, it's a protective award of up to 90 days pay per impacted employee. So it does carry potential expense on top of unfair dismissal claims, because there's every chance that if you get the collective process wrong, that's going to be fairly instrumental when a tribunal comes to look at an individual claim as well. So
yeah, definitely.
So there's three potential aspects of getting it wrong: unfair dismissal, criminal liability under HR1, and then this protective award as well.
And that that weekly award, it's not capped either, is it? There's no cap on the compensation.
It's actual pay.
You can actually spin up to, you know, literally hundreds of thousands of pounds quite quickly in terms of liability. So that really focuses the mind in terms of getting this process right. So just to recap then, our tips are, number one, don't get the numbers wrong. So make sure that you're right in terms of whether collective consultation has actually been engaged, because you don't necessarily want to do it if you don't have to. But if you do have to, given what we've just heard about the protective award, it's imperative that you do collectively consult. Secondly, don't start the consultation process too late. So you don't want to be too far formulated in your plans that you can't run a meaningful consultation exercise. But equally, I suppose it's true to say don't start it too early, because you do actually need a plan to consult on. Number three, don't forget the mandatory information. So be mindful of the Section 188 TOLCRA requirements, all of that mandatory information Adrian explained, and of course the HR1 form, which needs completing as well. Number four, don't neglect upskilling your employees. There's some real value in training the employee reps, even training the union reps, and helping and supporting those managers who are going to be running the exercise and applying scoring criteria as well. Number five, plan, but don't plan too much. So if you can invest a lot of time in terms of project planning, where you're looking at timescales, numbers, phasing of information, things like settlement agreements, and making some of those decisions, or having a position on some of those things in advance, it is going to pay dividends in the long run. And then finally, just be mindful of the costs of getting it wrong. because they're all the reasons why you should be diligent about this and do your best to try and get it right. So that's it for our session today. As I mentioned at the start, if you want to listen to any of our back sessions, just search out Employment Law 101 on Amazon Music and on Spotify as well. We welcome any feedback. In the meantime, we're just pulling together our program of events for the rest of the year. So if there's any particular hot topics you'd really like us to cover, please get in touch via LinkedIn or just via our website, NPM Legal. And we're very, very receptive to ideas. Our next session is going to be in 2 weeks' time. So 2 weeks today at 11 o'clock, we're going to be looking at artificial intelligence and what it means for HR and people managers. Mark, my colleague, and I did a really informative session yesterday in London where we were discussing this topic. A lot of interesting matter discussions came out of that, and we just want to share some of the insights with you. So join us 2 weeks today for that AI and employment law session. And in the meantime, enjoy your weekend when it arrives. Thanks very much.